Welcome to special post-election coverage from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Well, as I'm sure you've all heard now, in the national election, President Barack Obama won a second term, Democrats will retain control of the Senate, and Republicans continue to have a majority in the House of Representatives. Across California, voters decided to raise taxes to fund public schools and defeated a measure that would have banned unions and corporations from using payroll deductions to fund political campaigns. They voted to reform California's three strikes law, but not to ban the death penalty. Voters also decided not to label genetically modified foods. And in a surprise even for Democrats, the state legislature is now controlled by two-thirds majorities of Democratic representatives, a fact that could have a huge impact on the state. Let's start with California's Proposition 30, which was a tax hike to fund public schools for 7 years. Here's Governor Jerry Brown upon hearing the results last night.
Look, this was a tough battle. A lot of people say we couldn't do it. A lot of people said you're crazy to go to the people. But I ran for governor on the pledge that there'd be no taxes unless the people themselves voted for them. And in this case, they did. And it's only after, however, 30,000 fewer teachers. We had a massive budget deficit of $27 billion, and I've cut that thing, and we'll be in balance. This January, we'll have the first balanced budget probably since 1998.
It was one of the most closely watched propositions on the ballot. Its failure would have triggered $6 billion in automatic cuts to education. KLW's Casey Miner stopped by Frank McCoppin Elementary School in San Francisco's Richmond District this morning to talk with teachers about that result.
When she came into work this morning, kindergarten teacher Selena Chung didn't know whether she'd have a job next semester.
So this morning, we got the news that Proposition 30, which is the tax measure, did pass.
Oh, good, good, good. I'm happy that, you know, education could be saved.
Parent Siobhan Culhane hadn't heard either.
I did vote for it, but I haven't read all the results yet.
Could I tell you what happened?
Sure.
It passed.
Yay! Sorry, but yay!
The excitement was tinged with obvious relief and an obvious weariness among teachers and administrators already beaten down by repeated budget cuts over the past few years. Here's teacher's aide Connie Mason.
I'm relieved because when I watched yesterday off and on, it didn't look like it was passing. It's like, oh my God, what else are they going to cut from us? Really, you know, I mean, we're all here in this school. Everybody spends more time and their own money for a lot of things. So maybe that's going to ease us a little bit.
Principal Bennett Lee said he's also relieved, but that he doesn't think the fight for fully funded schools is over.
I'm a little skeptical always of anything that goes to the schools because a lot of things have been promised to the schools, and I don't know. I don't know if it's real or not. If it didn't pass, I would just go, oh, here we are, same as before. Just what we're going to cut here now, what else are we going to lose? I get excited when it actually starts happening, when I start seeing things happen.
For KALW News, I'm Casey Miner in San Francisco.
And joining us to discuss the results of yesterday's election locally and across the state, we have Robert Gammon, who's co-editor of the East Bay Express. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
And Marisa Lagos, who's a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Corey Cook, who's politics professor at the University of San Francisco. Hi, Corey.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, so there's a lot to discuss. A lot happened. So many ballots still uncounted, so things could change, and we'll keep you updated if we find anything out. But, Corey, why don't you go first? I mean, Proposition 30 was a really huge measure. It was not polling all that well up until a little while ago. What do you think is at stake with Prop 30?
Well, it not only was not performing well, it broke the rules that we all have of California ballot propositions. It is once it dips below 50%, when it was above it, that it doesn't come back. And I think so a lot of people had started to write the obituary for Prop 30 saying, you know, it had generically polled around 60% and then seemed to steadily fall as the attacks, in particular the Molly Munger's TV commercials on Prop 38.
So that was the competing Prop 38.
Right. And as you know, people had called the murder-suicide of the ballot propositions, that 38 was attacking 30, and as a result, 38 was declining, and 30 seemed to be falling too. I think people got pretty anxious that this was actually, you're not going to come back. And 30 is enormously important for California. I think, you know, in the current budget climate, you're talking about money going directly to K-12 education, a little bit to higher ed, a little bit to public safety. But in this budget year, it patches this gap that the legislature and the governor created with using these trigger cuts in this current budget. And then, you know, for the next 4 years at least, you're talking about, you know, $6 billion a year. It doesn't solve the state's long-term structural budget deficit. It doesn't, provide additional funding to schools, it doesn't get us back to where we were 3 years ago in terms of the state budget. But it
just stops the bleeding.
Stops the bleeding and gives the governor an opportunity now to work with the legislature to move forward. And I think that was what was so much at stake at this measure. Was the money is critical, but also in terms of the governor and the legislature, this did stop things and say, now we can actually focus on how do we actually, you know, create permanent solutions. We're right now just trying to solve the annual problems that were coming at just rapid fire.
Or mid-year problems, really. I mean, I think politically, you have to give this to Jerry Brown. He worked his butt off the last year and a half to not just build a coalition in support of this, but to really head off the people that could be against it. And so what you saw was business unions coalescing behind this. He was, got criticized for waiting too long. But I think if there's one thing we've learned in the last few years, that you should not doubt and Gus Brown and Jerry Brown when it comes to their
Don't
campaign
the
strategy. they seem to know what they're doing. I think that if they hadn't been able to get this through, it would have been a huge loss for Brown. It would have been really detrimental to Sacramento. Corey's right. It doesn't solve world peace by any means, but it does really give the legislature an ability to come back in January and focus on governing instead of trying to stop the bleeding, not only in the budget process, but mid-year. I mean, we haven't seen a year in a long time where they haven't had to come back and sort of deal with mid-year cuts or have this huge rollover deficit from one year to the next.
And schools had to have these plans of what they would slash mid-year.
Right.
Bob, what's your take on 30 and why 38 went down so definitively?
38 really surprised me. I didn't think it was going to lose by that big of a margin. 30, I think, it could be that this also benefited the presidential election. You know, as we know, nationwide polling was wildly different depending on the polling outfit. And so, but when it came down to it, California went big for President Obama. Democrats turned out in big numbers in California for President Obama, and that could do nothing but help a proposition like Prop 30. Prop 38, it just got hammered, and I don't really understand why.
And I think Brown was also helped by the get out the vote efforts on Prop 32, the anti-union measure. Unions really organized big for 30 against 32. There was also this introduction of online voter registration in September, how that broke, but that probably really helped Democrats. So there was definitely a number of things that helped. But, you know, I think you question when you look at the fact that and we'll talk about this, it looks like the legislature is going to be, you know, the Democrats are going to have a 2/3 majority there. Who knows whose coattails anybody was riding? I mean, it could have just been a perfect storm for Democrats in this state.
And Corey, you wanted to get in. And then I want to talk about this, something that was unexpected, which is the supermajority that Democrats are going to have in the state.
Well, a couple quick thoughts. One is that I think the genius of Prop 30 was the framing of this in terms of the trigger cuts. And I think, you know, critics of the governor and people who opposed Prop 30 at the outset said he's holding the state hostage. But what he did was he framed this in terms of real consequences to voters. And I think in California, we're used to voting on tax measures and voting separately on spending measures. And then we can disconnect the two as voters. So voters can say, I want to spend more on prisons. I want to spend more on schools. And on the other hand, I'm not going to vote for tax increases. And because those things aren't at all related, because they're separate measures. And what the governor was able to do was to say, there are consequences if you vote no, because there were consequences if you voted no, which was there were automatic trigger cuts in the state budget already. And that, again,
and people are going to see this in their neighborhoods, in their
you're
cities.
You're going to see schools end early. You're going to see real dire consequences that will occur if you don't vote yes. And normally, again, on ballot measures like this, there are not the argument that the cuts aren't real, Sacramento's just going to waste the money anyway, there's no real pain that's going to be caused if you don't vote for tax revenue measures. This is something that the governor effectively did. And again, opponents said they cried foul the minute it happened because it really reframed for voters. I still think this is very much an anti-tax state, but framed as, do you really want to end the school year early? Do you really want to, you know, destroy, you know, the CSUs and the UCs? Or do you want to vote for a temporary sales tax increase of a quarter of a cent?
So we still haven't actually fixed our problems.
We haven't fixed our problems, but it did frame it.
What do people do? They like to tax other people.
Exactly.
A cent on $4 worth of purchasing goods, like, that might be a tiny bit regressive, but it's not really that going to hurt anyone.
Well, you're listening to a special edition of KALW News. We're talking about the local and the state election results. I'm Holly Kernan. And one of the biggest stories of this election that nobody seemed to have been reporting on is that Democrats now have or appear to have a supermajority in both the Senate and the legislature. How is that going to change things?
Well, it's going to change things
I mean, it could change things drastically. It's a huge win for Democrats. It is something I think that part of the reason we didn't hear about was that they didn't want to talk about it. I mean,
they didn't think it was going to happen, right?
Well, we knew that it had a really good chance of happening in the Senate, although there are two Democratic senators that just won congressional seats, so those are going to be special elections. So, I mean, and there's also two races out there that are very close in the assembly, but both sides seem to acknowledge that the Democrats are going to come out ahead. I think what happened, one, is that the speaker sort of very quietly went into a couple of districts, didn't talk about it, and didn't go into late in the game, and Republicans didn't think it was going to happen. I mean, we also saw Republican voter registration fall to below 30%, so maybe it shouldn't be that shocking.
So what will it mean? Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I was going to ask, do you think redistricting had any role in this? I mean, these new districts and that created an advantage for Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could have. I think it's kind of too early to tell. I mean, I think the top two primary ironically didn't help them because they were fighting amongst themselves in some districts.
Right.
I think redistricting probably helped. I think that all of the sort of demographic things we've already discussed with 30 and 32 and the Republic, you know, the Democratic national races helped. But I think, what is it going to change? I mean, they now can raise taxes unilaterally without any Republican support. They can also actually try to really tackle some reforms, tax reform, initiative reform, things that people have been talking about. We'll see if they do. But, you know, we also still have Jerry Brown in the governor's office. He is not that liberal when it comes to this stuff. He's promised repeatedly not to raise taxes without going to the people. And they just got their tax increase. So I think it might at least, for the very short term, be a more of a symbolic win. And it could cause some problems for both Jerry Brown and the leadership, because now they're going to have all these Democrats who want things that they couldn't ask for before.
Corey, did you want to talk about the supermajority?
I think that's right. I think as a signifier, though, it's enormously significant. The Democrats have won every statewide office in California for the first time since 1883. They did that in 2010. So they had an unprecedented presidential election, the biggest victory in the presidential election in 2008 since, I believe, Roosevelt.
Right, then since 1933, right?
Yeah, and then in 2010, they win every statewide elective office for the first time since 1883. And then in this election now, they control two-thirds of both Assembly and Senate.
For the first time
ever,
time
as a Democrat.
Democrats. Yeah, anybody since early 30s.
Either party since the early 30s and first time for the Democrats. And so you actually, to me, the real question is, what is the relevance of the Republican Party currently in California? This massive decline of Republican registration being replaced and on the path to be replaced by decline to state voters is the second largest voter grouping.
Right,
in 21%,
I think, in the state, right?
And the Republicans I don't think it's redistricting. I think it's a real problem with the Republican brand. What they're losing is all of these close races. So where you have evenly matched candidates, and that's what's going on, is Democrats are recruiting very well in these competitive districts. And if you have evenly matched quality candidates, the Republican brand is toxic in California.
And then we have these open primaries now, and there was an upset in the race in Fremont where Democratic incumbent Pete Stark was defeated by another Democrat, Eric Swalwell, who is the Alameda County prosecutor. He's 31 years old. Stark is 80 years old, has served in Congress for 40 years, and our own KALW's Hanna Baba was at the Swalwell party last night.
At the victory party in Pleasanton, at least 80 supporters packed the Alameda County Deputy Sheriff's Association headquarters, cheering as the ticker on the bottom of the big TV screen said, California District 15, Swalwell 52%, Stark 47. James Moorhead holds up the homemade Honk for Swalwell sign that he and his 12-year-old daughter made. He sees Swalwell's victory as an endorsement of the open primary system.
It allowed people to challenge the incumbents in a way that simply was not possible before. So that's the other thing. There was a structural change. Eric saw an opportunity, took advantage of it.
Swalwell also resonated with the younger crowd. Something 18-year-old Cy Comedy said isn't possible for him with the incumbent Pete Stark.
He doesn't even live in this area. He actually lives in Maryland, and he's still representing this district. Eric Swalwell, he grew up here. He's been in Dublin for a very long time. And I think he's going to bring new energy and new change to Congress.
If this was a sporting event, he would be on the cover of ESPN Magazine, Sports Illustrated. This is one of the biggest upsets ever.
For supporter Sean Wilson, this is the democratic process at its best. Mobilizing local civic leaders really was key to Swalwell's success.
David and Goliath, that the machine, the political machine, doesn't always win. you can have hope and a dream, and if you do hard work, and it'll pay off. This is quintessential of a democracy right here tonight.
Swalwell himself beamed as he greeted his supporters, who all agree he ran a smart campaign. But to him...
There's no secret to success here. It's just, it's the hard work. I think when you go out the way that we went out there, full throttle for a year, and show people that you want the job, they'll reward you. And I think that's paid off tonight.
In Pleasanton, I'm Hanat Baba for KALW News.
And that piece was produced by KALW News. That was about the upset of Eric Swalwell, the victory over Pete Stark. So what do you think this means for Democrats going forward? And is this the kind of thing we're going to be seeing more of in the future with these open primaries?
Well, I think this is actually where we really can point to the independent redistricting as making a difference. I mean, this is not the only congressional race where we saw surprises or where we saw, you know, same party candidates fighting each other. But this one, I mean, you know, Stark had been in Congress for a really long time. He didn't live in the district. He had a lot of national support, but absolutely no local support. And I think Swalwell gets credit for running a good campaign. But you also just have to look at the fact. I mean, I think it's interesting that you would think that the legislature, who was drawing the lines before, would have had more of an interest in protecting themselves. But because they kind of had to make a deal with both sides of the aisle on that, I think that it was Congress where we really have seen this shift. And you're going to keep seeing this play out because there's other districts that are going to come up in the next couple of years.
And that's Marisa Lagos. She's a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. You're listening to a special report from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're doing post-election analysis of what happened in the state and here locally in the Bay Area. We're joined also by Robert Gammon, who's co-editor of the East Bay Express, and Corey Cook, who's a politics professor at the University of San Francisco. And Bob, you were saying that you think that we're going to see more of this.
I do, because what you had, Swalwell was really able to tap into the Republican votes in this district. He's mm-hmm. much more moderate than Stark. Stark's very liberal, right? And so what you have basically is Swalwell running as almost as the Republican candidate in a district that isn't really that liberal, you know. And so,
although Stark is very
liberal. Yes, see, in the past, Stark would go up against another liberal Democrat. Another liberal Democrats wouldn't take him on because he would probably beat them, and then he would face a Republican counterpart. And because the district does lean Democrat, he'd always win. Right, so it was a sure seat for a Democrat, a liberal Democrat, and now it may be a sure seat for a moderate Democrat, because the moderate Democrat has kind of taken the place of the Republican here.
Corey,
and you know, that is the consequence of the top two primary, which I think across the state, if you look at the places where we had these Democrats against Democrats, Republicans against Republicans, for the most part, these occurred in ideologically polarized districts. Mm-hmm. So the most part, you saw districts like the San Francisco Assembly District, where you have Phil Ting just won the Assembly race. So for the most part, these actually did not occur to have Republicans and moderates affecting the candidates, because for a candidate to move to the middle actually doomed them. But there are races like Pete Stark's race. There was a couple of Republican races that were actually pretty moderate ideologically moderate districts, where you do see this significant role of the other party's votes and decline to state voters in the general election.
Or a couple, the Berman Sherman race down in L.A. County. Democrats never would have let those two congressmen be drawn into the same district. The Independent Citizens Commission saw it differently, and that was a brutal knockdown, drag-out fight. At the end of the day, is there really that big of policy differences between those two men, who are both, by the way, middle-aged Jewish, almost look-alike? I mean, it was a very interesting race, but it was one of the nastiest fights, and I think that's because, we can talk about this in San Francisco, at a certain point, when you have very strong policy differences, it's a lot easier to sort of point those out than it is to get personal.
Well, let's talk about a huge policy difference, and that was Proposition 32. That was the ballot measure that was billed as political reform. It would have banned corporations and unions from using payroll deductions to fund political campaigns, but it really would have affected unions much more than corporations, because that's how they fund their political campaigns. I believe that the unions outspent the no on 32, the unions outspent the yes on 32 by something in the millions. Something,
I think it's about
10
million.
Of millions, yeah.
Yeah. So how do you analyze that victory for unions and defeat for
Well, I think there's a couple things. I mean, this is, as Corey talked about, a demographically fairly liberal state. And this is an issue that has been brought up repeatedly before voters. And this time they kind of got a little smarter and billed it as though this broader reform. But I think people saw through that. And I also think that some of what brought 38 down. I mean, unions spent big on that. People know that unions spend big. There's no question that union
money
is in politics. To support
30, to beat 32.
And really against 38 to a certain extent, the other tax initiative, which was, by the way, funded by Molly Munger. Her brother, Charles Munger, was the biggest contributor. He himself put in like $35 million to beat 32, or to pass 32 and beat 30. And then there was this infusion of like $11 million of dark money from out of state that went to court in the last few weeks. I think that stuff turns voters off. I do. I think that people, when you look at the numbers with 38, 30, it just wasn't about, you know, taxes are bad or taxes are good. I think that there was a lot of education in this campaign. And I think that unions were just successful in getting out their members and talking to people and scaring them. When we see all this dark money nationally, people don't like that in California. We've always had fairly strong, you know, campaign finance laws.
And so there were a lot of measures like this on ballots all across the nation that were aimed at the political power of unions. Bob, you were going
to
say?
I wonder about the total expenditure that unions have to make to continually fight these types of ballot battles, though. I mean, this is a huge amount of money that they had to expend in this election. And that's money that could have been spent elsewhere, perhaps in the United States, picking up congressional seats where there are opportunities, or could be put in the bank for something bigger at a later date. Instead, they had to really spend a lot here. So I wonder if we keep seeing ballot measures. This is the third time we've had this union
this same
check
kind
off.
Of,
ballot measure will keep coming back.
So do you think that California is the test case for this sort of thing?
No, I think Wisconsin and a lot of the other big states were test cases, but I think that it would have been a huge win for the right if they could have pulled this off in California. And, you know, I think it shows that, I mean, gosh, the Mungers spent so much money as a family on this election. Like, I was joking with somebody, you know, you couldn't just go on vacation. You could, like, buy a ski resort or whatever.
Corey.
I think people see through that.
Yeah, well, particularly when the money's on the yes side. When the money's on the no side. I mean, dark money coming on the no side is a different issue for California voters. It's when the perception is you're trying to get something over on them by getting them to vote yes on something they don't understand, that voters start to say, you know, if I'm not really inclined, I'm going to vote no. And so I think voters generally are, if they're confused, if they're frustrated, if you know they will tend to the no side. I think in this, I agree, the $11 million of outside money got caught up in the whole national narrative about super PACs and Citizens United and the 501c4s that were the American Crossroads and Crossroads GPS and these organizations.
Coach Brothers and these evil big
Coke
Brothers.
It got caught up all in that.
Found out that some of that money had come from it.
We
still have $11
million. Well, I'm still not entirely certain.
There's groups linked to the Koch brothers, but that is the thing.
Well, where money was able to defeat a proposition was with 37,
yes,
which would have forced people to label if genetically modified foods were used.
And those ads were devastating.
Yeah.
The ads were absolutely devastating. And it's not, whether you like 37 or not, if you were running a No on 37 campaign, you'd say, find me somebody in a white coat who can say there's no science behind it. Find me somebody who can say it's misleading. Find me somebody who can say it should be more.
That was the great thing about that campaign.
I can't believe they aren't regulating more than they're doing. This is so wrong.
Why would they say soy milk and not regular milk?
Right.
And they got outspent 5-1, the yes side. And I think that is an example where you see, you know, maybe in a different year, maybe if we hadn't had 10 or 8 or whatever statewide ballot measures in a presidential race, I mean, that actually could have been helped by a smaller ballot, whereas a lot of these, I think, were helped by
that big
ballot
drive to get people to the vote for 30 and 32.
People are confused about that one.
And what about Proposition 39? That seems to be a case where somebody was actually able to buy an initiative.
He did. This is Tom Steyer. And this was, this is basically to change a corporate tax kind of loophole that was put in as the result of a very messy budget deal when Schwarzenegger was governor. I'm not sure exactly why Steyer was able to buy that, but I would guess that maybe part of it is that
the clean energy.
Yeah, so
people
it's
that
for
idea.
Clean energy, it's for the budget. And it was sort of, it seems at least sort of altruistic, right? It wasn't somebody like the Munger, I guess Molly Munger's seemed altruistic, but they just dirtied her up so bad. No, there was no opposition to this, first of all, which is huge. Mm-hmm. But also, this is something that even Republicans and businesses were like, yeah, this isn't really fair. Small businesses hate it. People, you know, the job creators in our state hate it. And Steyer just was not painted as the boogeyman in the same way.
Corey?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, it passed with 60% of the vote. It passed in Riverside County, San Bernardino County. It passed in Orange County. I mean, this did very, very well across the state. Basically, any counties with people in them passed.
Even some without.
Really. Yeah, a couple of the ones, with four or five people. Yeah. In them. But this is exceptionally well in California, and I think it is that it's both that he found a loophole that does actually anger the business community, and he also was actively involved in Prop 32. And the No on 32 campaign, and making the argument, which I give him absolute credit for, which is that the environment business trade-off is not a trade-off. And he's been saying that about green technology and clean technology. He made that argument about why we should not repeal AB 32. And I think that was the argument that held in this too, is that we actually do want to invest in this in California. It's good for business and it's good for the environment.
I think one of the most effective things that the anti-Prop 37 side did, they spent $46 million. I think.
$46 million.
Yeah.
Versus how much on the Pro 37? Well,
it was not that much, like $8 million, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, I think the most effective argument they made is it's going to raise your grocery prices. And it was the same argument the American beverage industry made in Richmond against the soda tax. And
which we'll talk about soon.
Right. And people respond to that. They don't want to pay more for their groceries, and especially
was
in these
it
times.
True? Is it a true? Claim?
Well,
it
not could, clear. Not necessarily. It's not clear. I mean, it could be. It could be that some food companies would pass on the cost of labeling their food products to their consumers.
But $400 a year, which is what they claimed, probably
not.
You're listening to a post-election special from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and in a moment we'll discuss some of those local ballot measures like the soda tax in Richmond, which went down, and the sit lie law in Berkeley, and we'll continue to talk about California propositions and what happened and the implications, and we'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to post-election coverage from KALW News. It's a special. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're discussing some of the most important election results from around the Bay Area and around the state. We're joined by Robert Gammon, who is co-editor of the East Bay Express, Marisa Lagos, who's with the San Francisco Chronicle. She's a reporter, and Corey Cook, who's a politics professor at the University of San Francisco. You can get a recap of all of our elections coverage at kalw.org, plus links to all of their coverage. And we'll turn to the local races very quickly. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about the California propositions is that there were three criminal justice propositions on the ballot. And let's see. So there was the three strikes revision, which would change the three strikes law so that the third strike had to be a violent or serious felony. Voters, though, decided to keep the death penalty so far. And then there was Proposition 35, which is it was criticized, but it's about human trafficking, increasing the penalties on human trafficking. And we got a call this morning from San Quentin from an inmate on death row. His name is William Dennis, and he spoke with KALW's Nancy Mullane about the defeat of Proposition 34.
It's kind of back to a normal day. It's kind of quiet and stuff, and very subdued. There are a lot of people who are really hoping for it, and there are a lot that have been beaten down their whole lives and stuff and just feel like, well, this is just, can't get my hopes up. I was kind of hoping for some change, and that's what a life without would have meant. It would have meant being able to walk around the entire prison ground rather than being stuck in a little small area. But it's still the idea of, you know, being executed, and for those people who've run out of their appeals, you know, they still kind of hold on to that little glimmer of hope.
And that's reaction from death row to the news that Proposition 34 was likely to be defeated, which would have changed the death penalty to life in prison without the possibility of parole. That was William Dennis. He's been on death row for 24 years. And so what do you, all of you, we'll start with you, Robert, make of the way that voters voted on the ballot propositions on criminal justice? They were very different.
Yeah, clearly this is a proposition where, you know, Democrats obviously disagreed with each other, because California went overwhelmingly for Barack Obama and agreed on many issues, but on this one they didn't, and that's why it lost. I mean, there still is a strong pro death penalty feeling among many Democrats in California. And even though I think the pro 34 had a good campaign.
Yeah.
They made good arguments. They
But it's interesting that they didn't link the two, the death penalty and the three strikes. It's interesting that voters,
well, three strikes didn't want to link those. And I mean, that the three strikes measure, which passed with something like 68%, 66%
overwhelmingly.
Of the vote, overwhelmingly.
Yeah.
I mean, and you consider that compared to 8 years ago, when a slightly more, you know, less modest measure went down in defeat after this huge campaign against it by pretty much everybody in the political establishment. Prop 36, they were careful. They drafted it carefully. They really tried to stay under the radar. They didn't want a campaign. I mean, and they didn't get one, and they were happy about it because law enforcement was pouring all of their effort into beating Prop 34. And I think that, you know, even though it went down, this was a close vote. And this is a closer, I think, sort of, I think it speaks to the change, the sea change that's really happened with California and their views towards criminal justice reform. You know,
the whole get tough, just keep locking them up for longer and longer.
Well, on the money issue, Prop 34 really tried to make this about the wasted resources we're spending. And this is something that isn't just a liberal issue. I mean, we're seeing in states like Texas, not that they're repealing the death penalty by any means, but really, you know, people like Grover Norquist saying we can't keep just locking people up for no reason. And Prop 34, you know, proponents saying, and we can't keep paying tens of millions of dollars for, you know, these appeals that go on for decades. We haven't had an execution
in the state since 2005, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so I, you know, it's a loss, but I don't think it's a huge loss. I actually think they made a big inroad, and I think it speaks to some changes that are coming.
Does it speak to the sophistication of the voters?
I'm not sure about that. I don't mean to be critical of the voters. I just mean it still appears on the ballot as a pretty clear moral question. Do you favor the death penalty or not? And so I think the three strikes does speak to the sophistication of voters. I just think, you know, there are a handful of issues that actually voters treat differently, and those include abortion rights, and those include same-sex marriage, and those include death penalty, where it's I don't think the messaging about might this save money and what would it mean if we don't have to build a new death row and do we want people to have a cell to themselves or be part of the general population. I think your average voter looks at that and says, I know where I stand on this issue, I'm going to vote that way. So I agree with Marisa. I think it is a sea change in California. If you were to take this vote 10 years ago, it would have been very different, and 10 years before that, it would have been even more different.
Yeah.
And so I think it is part of this national, you know, there's a national movement to with moratorium and reform criminal justice. And I think California, it's finally come to California, because at the same time, we have a ballot measure that is standard California operating procedure on criminal
justice. Proposition 35?
That's right.
Yeah. So Proposition 35 is it would increase penalties for human trafficking. Many people criticized it who are against human trafficking as being not badly written.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's
potentially
a
having
concerns
unintended
that it
consequences.
Could, yeah, that it could potentially sort of sweep up people who are victims of human trafficking in its net, and also that it expanded the sex offender registry, which by a lot of accounts has been a pretty big failure in the state. I mean, we have now, you know, thousands of mostly men who are homeless and less stable because they aren't allowed to live anywhere because of, you know, the limits we placed on sex offenders. The ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation
just started a
lawsuit. They filed a lawsuit basically saying because it not only requires these new sex offenders to hand over all their internet information to law enforcement, but all sex offenders on the registry, they're saying this violates their rights to political speech and other things. There is some precedent. It'll be a tough road for the ACLU to win this, but I think that this was one, again, that was like could have been in another year, really had a different campaign. And I think that it sounded good and people went for it.
And that's Marisa Lagos with the San Francisco Chronicle. We're talking about the election and analyzing the effects locally and statewide. You're listening to a special from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm joined also by Robert Gammon, who's with the East Bay Express. He's co-editor. And Corey Cook, who's politics professor at the University of San Francisco. And let's turn to some of the local ballot measures, some of the city measures that may have national and statewide implications. Richmond voters were considering a tax on sodas, and ALW's Isabel Angel was with the measure in supporters at the Yes on N headquarters in Richmond when they got the news last night that it had not passed.
Spirits were high as the TV blared news of President Obama's re-election, but the mood changed as it became clear that Measure N probably wouldn't pass. The measure was designed to fight childhood obesity, but beverage companies and local businesses poured in over $2.5 million to oppose the tax. Andre Soto, a co-founder of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, tried to look on the bright side.
That's a badge of honor that our movement has caused them to reach that deep into their pocket to spend unprecedented amounts of money.
Councilman Jeff Ritterman, who wrote the measure, is disappointed but still hopeful.
I predict that there'll come a time you'll pick up a can and on the side of the can it'll say, "Warning, regular consumption of this beverage will increase your risk for a heart attack, stroke, and diabetes," because that's the truth.
But this time, voters sided with their local restaurants and grocery stores, whose opposition to the tax effectively killed the measure. For KALW News, I'm Isabel Angel in Richmond.
And that's about the Richmond Measure N, I think it was. It would be a tax on soda. And so looks like the American Beverage Association is the winner in that race. How do you analyze that?
They spent a huge amount of money, $2.5 million. It was the most expensive campaign in the East Bay this year by far. They blanketed the city of Richmond with billboards, mailers. I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without saying no on Measure N ads. And they, like the anti-Prop 37 folks, made a compelling argument that this is going to, you know, make your groceries much more expensive. And it's going to and they especially went after it, it's going to punish low-income people the most. And so, and, you know, ironically, this measure was designed to deal with obesity, especially in low-income areas of Richmond. And so it was a big defeat. They lost by 66-33%, I think.
Yeah, 66.9, so almost 70% of the voters were against it. And you wrote an article, Robert, today called Breaking Bad, and you were talking about how negative races in the East Bay really were this year.
Yeah, I've been covering East Bay politics now for about 15 years, and this is easily the most negative I've ever seen it.
Why do you think that is?
In Oakland, I think it was negative, especially because you had two high-profile races where there was clear favorites in the races, and so the underdogs spent a lot of money, and they went negative. They went negative early, and they just stayed negative throughout the entire campaign. It backfired. They didn't win. They lost handily.
So are you referring to the Ignacio de la Fuente, Rebecca Kaplan, city council at large in Oakland?
Yes, that race, and also the city attorney's race between incumbent Barbara Parker and Councilwoman Jane Bruner. So Bruner and de la Fuente were the underdogs. They were behind the polls most of the campaign, so they decided to spend a lot of money on going negative advertising. And they were assisted by the Oakland Police Officers Union, who supported those two candidates. And they spent quite a bit of money going negative. But at the end of the day, voters rejected it in Oakland. Kaplan won by 20 points and Parker won by 35 points.
And there's still 140,000 uncounted ballots in Alameda County. What races are still at stake?
The biggest race that's still at stake is probably Measure B1.
Tell us what that would do.
That would raise $8 million a year, or $1 billion a year, excuse me, for transit projects throughout the East Bay. Not only just road projects, but also for mass transit, for smart growth development, for bike paths, for pedestrian walkways. It would do many different things. It had widespread support. It's a half-cent sales tax increase.
Mm-hmm. And it needs to pass by
66.7. Yeah. It currently has about 65.6 or something.
We just got word that it's up.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they may have updated the latest totals tonight while we were on the air.
Right, they're counting ballots as we speak.
Right, and so they're going to keep that. That's going to fluctuate back and forth over the next week as they finish out all those all the late absentees and provisionals. Another one to watch that's going to be very close is Measure S in Berkeley.
That's the sit-lie, which the ordinance that we already have in place in San Francisco.
Right. That one is losing by about 1.5 points last time I looked, but that could change. Berkeley looks like it has about 30,000 outstanding ballots to be counted in that city. And so another one there that's very close is Measure T, which is the development proposal for West Berkeley.
For West Berkeley. Right. And that got very little coverage.
It did.
And that went very negative toward the end.
It did. We covered it in the East Bay Express. Some of the local, hyper-local websites in the East Bay covered it, like Berkeley Side did a really good job with it. And at the end of the day, we won't know probably for a week to 10 days how it fared.
How that will go. Yeah. And Marisa, let's talk about San Francisco. The big proposition was Proposition A to fund City College.
Yeah, and that passed pretty easily. I mean, this is the sort of irony, I think, of San Francisco. We can talk about, you know, the sheriff and all of that drama and how negative things have been and how far apart people are. But pretty much the city voted in lockstep with itself on every measure on the ballot. I mean, there was only maybe one or two propositions and local measures where support or opposition, depending on which side was winning, was below like 70%. So, yeah, City College, big win for them. They've been fighting for their life, so to speak.
And so that's Measure A. It's a parcel tax that raises $14 million a year for City College. And City College student trustee William Walker was delighted with that result.
I think that City College is a lot happier tonight. And I think that San Franciscans stepped up to the challenge of funding public education here in San Francisco, something that has not been a priority for our state. I mean, there are a lot of questions that were thrown at members of the board that, you know, well, are you guys really responsible enough to be given a blank check for City College of San Francisco? And I think that the college has demonstrated that we're willing to put in the types of safeguards that ensures that all the funding that comes in from Proposition A will go back to where it needs to go at the college to make sure that we retain our accreditation and continue serving students as the largest workforce trainer in the city.
And that was City College student trustee William Walker speaking with KLW's Jen Chien. And incidentally, Walker was running for a board seat, but he lost. He did say that pending the outcome of Prop 30, City College had two schedules to release today for the spring semester, a full schedule or a shadow schedule. So it looks like the city stepped up to the challenge. That was a really big deal.
It was. I mean, you know, he mentioned this accreditation issue. Obviously, if you've been in the city, you've heard about this. They have had enormous fiscal challenges, threats to remove their accreditation. They've been forced to make some huge reforms to the chagrin of faculty and some students. And I think that they demonstrated that they could do it well enough that, you know, voters were willing to back this. I'm sure the fact that it's San Francisco didn't hurt.
And then the measure to drain or to study, the proposal to study draining Hetch Hetchy was soundly defeated.
It went down in flames. It was over 70%. And I think that, again, that speaks to really, I mean, we saw this with Measure E, too, which is this changing the way businesses are taxed in the city. I think when you have sort of all sides of the progressive and democratic stalwarts coming together for or against something, city voters listen. And that was the case with both the Hetch Hetchy thing and with E.
Measure F. That, I think that's an interesting case because I think that's a case where in the rest of California it would have overwhelmingly won.
Why?
But because I think that most Californians aren't okay with the fact that a national park is
damned.
Yes, look at the Los Angeles Times came out heavily with a series of columns about this against the in favor of something like Measure F. Sacramento B has been, I mean.
Yeah, but you have to look at the water wars that happen between those counties, too. I mean, I think that it's.
Well, I don't know necessarily those newspapers are necessarily representing the water wars. I think it's the general feeling. I know it is in the East Bay. I think it's pretty safe to say that most people, like, going, San Francisco, what are you thinking? But San Francisco's kind of on an island here.
Well, and it's not just San Francisco that gets the water there, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, Corey.
So the other one that didn't get much attention is Proposition C, which is this this affordable housing fund. And that was, as Marissa said, this is a broad coalition. It's not often that you get all these folks in a room together. But, you know, the decline of redevelopment agencies, this cost half of the city's affordable housing budget disappeared overnight. 50% of the city's affordable housing budget was gone. And so for the mayor and the board of supervisors to sort of work out a deal with affordable housing providers, with advocates, of with for-profit developers, it was a broad sort of coalition, but one that I think, you know, had the potential to really crumble, actually. And ultimately, you know, this got over 60% of the vote. But so I think that was another sort of, again, victory for the, quote, city family in San Francisco, right?
And in San Francisco, the voters also passed Proposition G, essentially an anti-Citizens United. It says it's San Francisco policy that corporations are not persons. Obviously, largely ceremonial, but interesting.
Yeah, from what I understand, too, we were one of at least 100 cities and counties around the nation that did this. Which I think, you know, a lot of times people roll their eyes at these policy statements that we love in the Bay Area, right? I
mean, Berkeley loves them.
Yeah. We love them in San Francisco. But I think this is one that, you know, back to the issue of dark money and campaign finance and the presidential race, and there could be some effect if enough local and state governments really push back on this, that it could pressure Congress in some way. I could be totally wrong, but it did seem to be one of the few ones that it wasn't like complete eye roll. Oh, my gosh. Like, oh, San Francisco's against the Iraq War. Great.
Gotcha. OK, can you also give us a quick recap of the supervisors' races in San Francisco? I know that some are still undecided, partially because of ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
And what's the Mercurimi effect?
Well, it looks like Christina Loggi, who was appointed to replace Mercurimi by, you know, the more moderate mayor, Ed Lee, and then shocked the world. We think of ourselves as the world in San Francisco when she voted to keep Mercurimi in office after his guilty plea to a misdemeanor related to some allegations about abusing his wife. Looks like she is going down. London Breed, the sort of more moderate candidate, is in the lead in ranked choice voting. The elections head today said he would be shocked if Breed didn't keep the lead. District 7, the other really heavily contested one, is still up in the air. Union favorite FX Crowley is in the lead, followed by
Norman Yee.
I can look it up.
Norman Yee, yes. School board member Norman Yee, sort of the more progressive favorite. And so that one I think will take a few days to sort out. Otherwise, the incumbents really showed strong. Even Eric Marr in District 1, who had a pretty strong challenge from sort of
David Lee.
He came out pretty strongly ahead. And David Hsu had no problem as expected. David Campos.
Even though he voted against the Mercurimi.
No, David Campos and Avalos did, but they were both running unopposed.
Okay.
So it was kind of, I think three people wrote in against.
The District 1 race, the Eric Marr race, is the most expensive supervisorial campaign in San Francisco history.
Why?
There's a lot of outside money. There's an incredible amount of outside money. And the perception was that this race, if David Lee were to win, would shift sort of the fulcrum of the board.
So that goes along with this trend of outside money not really working.
And I think actually in this case, and I guess maybe it's because I live now in District 1, it's not just the diminishing returns of money, but I think we got into Meg Whitman territory where it began to hurt.
It was really negative.
It was really nasty, and it was every day, and it was just the viral video thing, the Send Marr Back to Mars thing that got some attention.
Although Eric Marr had a very good ground effort, he was putting Post-it notes on people's doors apparently.
But a 16% margin of victory. I mean, he narrowly won 4 years ago. He was perceived to be at real risk in his district. I think he worked really hard, and he has worked really hard for 4 years. But this was a blowout, which I don't think a lot of people expected. Mm-hmm.
So we're running toward the end of the hour here, and I want to get a couple more questions in for each of you. Was there something that just surprised you the most in this election, Marissa?
Well, I think the decisiveness of some of the statewide outcomes, and I was looking at just the maps on the Secretary of State's site, which if you are campaign politics dork like all three
political
of us,
junkie,
you should totally do. fascinating to see. I mean, some of the stuff, like, you know, kind of how we expected. Props 30 and 32 really broke around this sort of inland, more conservative counties and the liberal, sort of more blue counties.
Inland versus coastal, which also tracks national trends.
Right. But then with Prop 36, the Three Strikes Initiative, it went up in every single county. And so I was just really fascinated by that. I mean, obviously, you know, the two-thirds thing kind of came out of left field. And, you know, the next thing in San Francisco is
that's the supermajority in the California state legislature.
Sure. And then the big thing we're going to be watching now in San Francisco is who's the next board president. As Corey just mentioned, you know, Eric Marr winning kind of keeps it as a pretty solid progressive majority. I think there's some thought that David Chu, the current president, won't try for that position again if it doesn't look like he can get it. So, you know, but London Breed does change them. So it'll be an interesting next few months in SF.
Go ahead, Robert.
In the East Bay, really, getting back to this whole negative political advertising thing. I mean, you know, the political playbook is negative advertising works. That's why campaigns do it. But I think in the East Bay this year, people will be rethinking it in the future, you know, because much
so
the
does
negativity.
Does it work a lot better at a national level than maybe at a local level?
I don't know.
Level?
I think the jury's out as to where it works and when it doesn't work. But in the East Bay this year, it didn't work well in many of the many places that it was done.
And who did you give your Golden Turkey Award to for
to
worst...
Ignacio de la Fuente this year? And it
for
was
the
basically,
most negative.
He did, and basically because he crossed the line over the past week and with a homophobic slur against his competitor.
Rebecca Kaplan, who did win that seat.
Yeah, she won going away. And it was kind of sad to see.
Corey?
I would say to me, the negativity is in part because these are, you know, down ballot races in an incredibly expensive election year. I mean, there are 6,600 different ads run around the country in the presidential election, 6,600 different ads in these races. I mean, those are unique spots.
And I believe that $6
billion
$6 billion
And so I think as a result, you get ads like this one we saw in the Eric Marr race, which is just, you know, trying to get some free media attention, and you sort of throw stuff at the wall. And I think that's, again, I think it's part of this broader politics of problems in our politics. But I think to me the real surprise actually of anything is, you know, in 08 when Obama won and won decisively, 2.1 million new voters in California, it didn't tilt the margin at all on ballot measures. Things that had been on the ballot that time that had been on the ballot 2 years earlier, the results were exactly the same. Didn't have an effect on assembly races, Senate races. There was no down ballot consequence other than Obama won by a ton. This time out, there are about 900,000 new voters, and they seem to have reshaped California politics. And I think we might have anticipated that in 2008 and didn't see it. And this time around, it's like, I think we just saw a sea change election.
And that California might be a bellwether for the national landscape in terms of the changing demographics here. Well, final thoughts on that, Marisa, before we go.
Well, I think if we're going to give Golden Turkeys, we should give maybe a real award to, you know, a big winner in this
Golden Platter.
Lost in the mayor's race last year, Leland Yee. He wrote the online voter registration law that did a lot for Democrats, for liberals statewide. And I think it's going to continue to really help get a new generation of voters to the polls, interested in politics. And no matter what your political persuasion, that's a good thing. I mean, we live in a democracy. We want voter turnout, and so I don't know. I'm gonna strike a hopeful note. I feel like people are getting smarter and thinking more, and I hope I'm right.
I think that's true. I mean, conventional wisdom coming in for many people was that young voters were not going to turn out like they did in 2008. But it turns out, according to the exit polls that I saw last night, they did, which is an encouraging sign.
Yeah, that enthusiasm gap did not materialize. Young people turned out. People of color turned out. And
right.
In California, there's a large Asian American vote and Latino vote. And that looks to be the future of the
and
vote.
I think the GOP, both especially in California, but certainly nationally, has a lot of issues that they're going to have to really tackle. Immigration being one of them. I mean, changing demographics, Latinos in particular, is a huge issue helping Democrats this year everywhere.
And Corey, I'm going to give you the final 30 seconds.
Okay, and I think that's exactly right. The Republican coalition this time nationally, 92% of Romney voters were white voters. You know, you're looking at a party that had to win 62% of the white vote, almost 65% of the white male vote in order to win the presidency, and falling just short of that, still doing as well as has been done by a Republican nominee since 1988, the most racially divisive election we've had since 1988. And that's going to stop now. I mean, the demography is going to fundamentally change that. The Republicans can't continue to run these types of elections.
So goes California, so goes the nation. And you've been listening to a special live elections wrap-up from KALW News. I want to thank our guests. You just heard from Corey Cook, who's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. We've also been joined by Robert Gammon, who's co-editor of the East Bay Express, and Marisa Lagos, who's a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Today's special coverage was produced by Martina Castro, Casey Miner, and Seth Samuel. Special thanks to our volunteers, Eva Sonsan, Lila Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Alyssa Kapnick, Resu Sussman, and Nina Nicole Morente for helping us out today. And to our Election Day reporters, Hana Baba, Ali Budner, RTM's Kunahoffs, Kyungjin Lee, Casey Miner, Isabel Angel, Jen Chien, and Julie Kane. Our web coverage is overseen by Audrey Dilling. Our elections coverage was coordinated by RTM's Kunahoffs and overseen by our executive editor, Ben Trefney. For ongoing election-related news, stay tuned to KALW.org, where you can also find all of our reports from throughout the day. For KALW News, I'm Holly Kernan.